Thanks, Stephen. And I agree that the timing is particularly significant and important. And I think these issues are quite critical for industry and for science and research. So it's an excellent time to have this discussion. And it looks to me like we've got great panels all throughout the day. So I'm looking forward to hearing and participating as well. So in terms of the agenda for my part of the presentation, I do want to talk a bit about the traditional space for rights and licensing in the STM sector. I want to talk a bit about business models and open access. I do want to talk about the implications of Gold OA in particular and some of the requirements that Stephen mentioned with respect to RC UK and Wellcome Trust and licensing aspect. And then finally, because of those requirements, I want to spend a fair amount of time talking about Creative Commons, its background, and its approach. And I do have the quote here from Article 27 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and I think it is particularly appropriate. It's perhaps a bit dated, but it actually addresses both dimensions of this discussion. It does talk about access. It does talk about the impact on scientific knowledge. But at the same time, it also talks about recognizing the integrity and contribution of the works of authors. So it seemed to me a nice summary of the key issues here. So I'm going to talk about the rights and the sort of traditional approach that is taken in STM publishing. And essentially, as probably 90% of you know, there's two dimensions and two sides to it. What we sometimes refer to as the upstream, the ability to get rights from the author to the journal, and then the kind of the downstream side. So how exactly do we clarify what rights, what usage rights, what further rights, secondary rights, secondary exploitation, users and others have out there. So there's the upstream side and the downstream side. And I'd say that the discussion about various licensing options and schemes has a part to play on both parts of the licensing streams. And I think that all of this will still continue to happen no matter what happens with respect to the business model. In terms of creative licensing, I think that this industry in particular has worked hard to do some interesting and fairly creative things. So this industry, unlike some other copyright industries, have been very much focused on putting content online, on the internet, and making things accessible that way, and to also change the nature of the article and the objects that are actually posted and made available on the internet. And licensing schemes have to come along with that. I would say that what we started with, probably in the late 1990s as far as licensing, is actually probably comes pretty much from the software industry, and that's both unfortunate and perhaps helpful. It's always good to start somewhere and have a model to use. But I do think that it's true that software is quite a bit different from published articles. So I think the way that we found ourselves working in an online world was to take some of these models and then try to anticipate what we needed to do to make them clearer, to really cover the specific uses that we saw as highly relevant for our library customer market in particular, to deal with warranties and service issues, and frankly, to push as much of this online and to make it as much electronic as possible. So to really get away with this kind of, you know, written thing on paper as much as we could. Not always possible, but you want to push as much as you can. I think the anticipated uses is particularly important in our sector because the traditional library customer is really used to building collections of content. So the notion that came to us from the software licensing world, which is basically as long as you had a paid-up license, you had the ability to use that piece of software, and often that right went away if you stopped paying for it or stopped keeping your license current, wouldn't really work in our industry. So this was, I think, a really key issue for us. Finally, also, you can often think about copyright issues in terms of buying books and buying journals, but in this new environment, we also deal with questions about services and warranties, and those also had to be dealt with in the contracts. And I think for us, we often found ourselves looking at the kind of traditional American-based software license, which basically disclaims every liability that you can possibly imagine, and those that you can't imagine. And I think we were creative in saying, actually, our library customers do expect something from us, so let's be clear about what it is that we can actually stand behind. So that's kind of what we did in the 1990s. Now, publishers were not the only ones out there doing interesting things with digital objects and electronic publishing and licensing. Lots of others were as well, and I think particularly drawn from the academic and research space. And I think a lot of experiments were started adopting from open source licensing, which again comes from software. So you see there's a theme here of everything sort of comes from the software industry or software issues originally. And we'll talk a bit more about open source licensing and what the implications of that are. So I think, you know, we're not the only ones out there. I do think that the approaches that we took were important and were very helpful in establishing the way folks are accessing content online now. So I will talk a little bit about business models in OA. I think everyone in the room understands the essential differences between green and gold, but just to put it into context, traditional copyright models in terms of sustainable business models for publishing generally involved selling access, selling copies, or selling a right to copy. And therefore, in STM publishing space, which was very much about subscriptions and permissions. Obviously, when content is free at the point of access, under any OA model, things are different, and yet some things still stay the same. I think that on the green side of open access, licensing is still important, but probably the critical factor here is the rights that are negotiated between author and journal with respect to how things are posted online, what versions, what issues with respect to any waiting periods, and that kind of thing. On the gold side, there's a lot more focus on the user license, which is why the emphasis on Creative Commons. So they play on slightly two different parts of the two streams of licensing, green a bit more on the upstream side, and gold a bit more, I would say, on the downstream side. So just to look at that in a little more depth, in the journal publishing agreements between authors and publishers, there are often requirements essentially dealing with metadata to identify the journal, to update the posted record, and that's of course why I have the reference to the Crossmark project and program here, because that's an awfully good way to check to see what's going on with respect to versions of records. And to include the DOI link so that the final version of record is in fact findable. And the entire record can be cited, or at least leads to a citation pattern of some kind. The JPA often indicates if there's any further use or distribution limitations, and talks about a specified waiting period often. Not always, but often. So again, most of that comes from the upstream licensing side. I think if we go to the gold side, as mentioned, this is much more about user licensing. And here we see that funding agencies or other institutions and governments are requiring authors to post, and even sometimes to a specified site, to post a final version, or the article of version, to use the NISO ALPS standards from 2008 about how to describe article versions. Although I would note that although it's a final version, some publishers are experimenting and offering discounts with respect to different versions, so that introduces some complexity, but that's an issue to acknowledge, I think. And then some discussion about the specified period within which the content is to be made accessible. So these are the obligations that are coming from the funding agency, as Stephen alluded to with respect to RC UK, for example. And publishers that are engaging in OA publishing in some fashion are going to generally include the online usage terms and conditions. And this is really the area that I think we're going to explore in more depth today. So, what are those downstream licensing requirements? An example, of course, of those requirements is the requirement or suggestions to use a Creative Commons license, and often the CC version that permits the maximum reuse, as mentioned in the letter from the Story and History Journal editors, the CC BY license. Now, publishers, I think, are also adopting to CC approaches in any event. First of all, I think we have to acknowledge that there is a market demand. And that has to do with the notion of apparent simplicity. People believe that they understand what the Creative Commons license permits. They may be wrong, but they believe they do. In part, that's because of the structure of the Creative Commons license. For example, the human readable part that we'll look at as we look at the CC layers. Those are terms of use which seem clear, seem simple, and seem understandable. And that, of course, was the point of them, to try to kind of really be broadly understandable in license terms. Sadly, my profession doesn't often lend itself to simplicity and clarity, and sometimes does the opposite. So I understand that there is great need to push in this area. So these are, I think, some of the key points and the reasons why publishers might be doing something like Creative Commons or Creative Commons in any event, because of these kinds of market demands. I will say, and I'll say something about the apparent simplicity issue, which is, if you've ever spent time, as sadly I have, looking at the actual formal legal code that underlies the CC licenses, they're just as badly drafted as any other license I've ever seen. They're full of definitions and exceptions and cross-references and annexes and appendices, and they look like any other license. So, but they have good press, and they have good market position. I want to delve a little bit into the history of Creative Commons, and to do that, you have to go to the open source movement, which started roughly in 1983 and then became open source in 1998. Now, this concept involves engineers posting their own code, software modules, that can then be used by other engineers and recombined, and new versions are reposted. I think fundamental here to this movement was a notion of change in the way that software was going to be used. There was a definite sort of anti-corporatist feel to the movement. I think there was a strong sense that the software had been sort of taken over by the Microsofts of the world and the SAP of the world, and this was an attempt to sort of right the balance and to permit individual software engineers to produce content and make it available on the internet and encourage others to do the same. So in terms of the building on the shoulders of giants, you can see that this type of movement is very directly about that. Because, after all, software is operationally something that combines or can combine with other modules and other software. I'm sure a true software engineer would say that I'm being very simplistic, and it's far more complex and difficult than that, as it probably is. But the point of open source software is you're supposed to be able to take a module that does some application and plug it into a larger work stream that you're developing. That's the basic concept. So it does really sort of work together in that kind of remix culture, if you will, but in a very operational way. The GNU, General Public License, has also become very influential, not only in open source, but as you'll see in the discussion about Creative Commons, it flows through into the Creative Commons license language as well, particularly the concept of share alike. Share alike is essentially what I was talking about before. It's the notion that someone is going to post something, a software module on the internet, other people are going to use that. The share alike model says that that second user has to then post the revised code that they have worked on onto the internet for others to be able to use. So that's the basic concept of share alike. What I think is interesting in looking at OS is that OS has a plethora of licenses. In fact, some individual engineers have created their own licenses. So you can imagine that the notion in Creative Commons that we develop certain license models might make a good deal of sense, because frankly, as a corporate lawyer trying to evaluate open source use within my own company, you sometimes struggle a lot to understand the precise terms and conditions of licenses. Some open source license requires, for example, that any code which has, you know, any complete code which has an element, one simple module of an open source license, must therefore be made fully and wholly available. Others will say, no, it's just, you know, the module in which you used that particular line of code. So there's a lot of variations. But the basic notion of share alike is really fundamental to the open source movement, and interestingly plays through in the Creative Commons history as well. So in Creative Commons, which was founded by Lawrence Lessig of the Free Culture fame and others in the sort of 2001-2002 time, I think the key concept here, it definitely builds on the open source movement. In fact, it makes reference in the history section at creativecommons.org to that, to the GNU license in particular. It builds on that because it also is meant to be anti-corporatist, if you will. The notion of Creative Commons when it got going was that it was meant to be empowering of individual creators and provide a legal support for creators to go directly to market, if you will, directly to the internet, without the intervention of publishers, producers, broadcasters, and the like. So it was meant to be quite empowering in that sense, and it was meant to be a mechanism to enable people to do things directly and to do things for themselves, but hopefully in a way that would call upon, you know, legal contracts, legal enforcement of contracts, and legal traditions to make that effective and worthwhile. It does have a general pro-sharing bias. If you look at the kind of variations of Creative Commons, there's a fair amount that even use the words share alike. So that's a concept that also sort of comes through from open source. And this is supposed to be a contrast, and you'll see some commentary in the founding of Creative Commons where people talk about some rights reserved versus all rights reserved. Sadly, most of us are familiar with the litany, all rights reserved, which comes from some completely strange convention, the UCC convention, I think, isn't it? And which somehow worked its way into all of our lives. But if you think about what some rights reserved versus all rights reserved means, the implication is in some rights reserved, which is sort of attached conceptually to Creative Commons, the notion is that there's a broad grant of rights and only a few rights are reserved. Whereas in the propaganda discussion about this, the conception is a traditional copyright industry model is we're just going to give you a narrow grant of rights and everything else is excluded. I'm not quite sure that that's fair either way, but that's kind of the way the opposite poles are described. And again, I think that this was meant to be an empowering thing for individuals. It was meant to go from a broadcast world to a narrowcast, or even a one-to-one and to, in a sense, create a sort of market for individuals to deal with the broader world. That was just the history section. Now, I'm just going to spend a few minutes digging into the layers and the sort of more operational side, if you will, of Creative Commons. So you might have seen the kind of chart with the three different layers. So the three layers are the computer code, that's the machine-readable bit at the top, the symbols and the simple explanation, which is kind of the human-readable part as it's described, and then the full bore, full-on, exhaustive legal license text, which I suspect no one, except for some of the lawyers in the room, ever reads. So that's kind of the layering. I'll talk about how that works. The code and the symbols and the simple explanation are what's supposed to be built into the digital object when that object is posted online, so that the computer can read the fact that there is a Creative Commons license being used, so that a human can understand that as well, and a human can follow a link to the Creative Commons site in order to understand and read the full licensed legal text. So that is really how this is supposed to work operationally. And to be frank, I think that most people believe that Creative Commons is actually about that human readable slice, because that's what people are most familiar with. It's the symbols, it's the one-line explanation, which, by the way, I think is a good model for actual licensing. So that's what I think most people think it is, and I guess I'm just trying to say here that that's not all that it is, operational. So we've talked about the fact that one of the interesting differences between open source and Creative Commons is that Creative Commons really focused on license language. It said, look, we're going to have a couple of standard sets of licenses with a couple of different variations in terms of rights granted, rights reserved, and that's how we're going to give this tool to folks that are creators so that they can use this formally approved license language on the internet. And Creative Commons is a fairly sizable organization. They've worked with lawyers around the world. And actually, the variations that we see here, the six, have been translated into many languages and vetted by local lawyers in those countries. And there are slight variations in the language to try to be more part of the local legal tradition. So it's six plus some number, but it's quite a large number. Now, I think a lot of things that you can notice here. First, you notice that attribution is required for all. Now, that, I think, is fundamental in science research and in publishing in any event, that you want authors and creators to be identified as the author, so that it kind of ties into the moral rights of paternity and maternity, and also, well, there are other moral rights, including integrity issue, which we'll talk about later. But there's strong recognition of attribution. I take Stephen's point and the historian's point that, to some extent, it may not be all that reassuring to be identified as someone if the point of the paper is somehow misused or turned around in some fashion. But there is an attribution, and that is has a moral rights dimension to it, which is there. The CC-BY license, which is the license which has been discussed by Wellcome Trust and by RCUK, is the most permissive. It's any and all use is permitted, provided you do the attribution. So commercial use, fine. Derivative use, fine. All kinds of work. The share-alike CC-BY is a little bit different in that it does require, if you will, for the share-alike function which comes from open source. It works a little bit differently in Creative Commons. In Creative Commons, the way it works is that you have to, if you're using this element, you have to then make your secondary work available on the same license terms and conditions to others. So that's how the share-alike function works in Creative Commons. And then I'm going to dig into the no derivative, non-commercial issues in more depth in just the next slide or two. But I think it's just interesting to look at the slide here, and you'll notice that they all have attribution. Two have the share-alike requirements. Three include non-commercial restrictions. And one has the no derivative clause. And I just think it's interesting how those variations work. It doesn't work, by the way, that the one at the top is the most permissive and the one at the bottom, well, the one at the bottom probably is the most restrictive, but the ones in the middle are not necessarily on an even, they don't work from most restrictive to most permissive. They're just variations, depending on what the individual creator thought was important. So, what are the implications about those variations? I think on the derivative versus non-derivative, in the copyright industries, I think we understand what derivative works are, maybe. There are things like adaptations, translations, abstracts, edited variations, other versions, excerpts. Those things are sort of commonly understood as they apply to journal articles, journal content, books, book chapters, and the like. The new area of text and data mining, which has come up very strongly to the fore over the past year or so, would probably also fit into here, although part of TDM is a usage right, and part of TDM is the display of the results or doing something with the results. And it's the doing something with the results that probably has the derivative works issue. So these things are commonly understood. I think what does worry some, and we saw it in the comments that Stephen mentioned, is the idea that a work could be created which, although it might properly give attribution, might imply something rather different from what the author originally meant. So I think this is worrying to some, and I'm not sure that it's an issue that's been considered enough by all involved. We have seen some industries play at the edges, and I'll talk about this on the commercial, non-commercial side as well. With using journal content, which has, you know, many of the attributions in terms of editing, peer review, quality, the kind of quality stamp of the journal, being used in ways that suggest an association with a particular drug or a particular medical treatment. Those kinds of things, I think, are very worrying. If we talk about commercial versus non-commercial, I know that for many of the societies for whom we publish at Elsevier, and I think this is fairly common throughout the industry, those societies are often highly concerned about what advertising is associated with content that they publish or with particular articles that they publish. And the interesting thing about the commercial definition in the Creative Commons license is that it's both interestingly vague, so primarily intended for or directed towards commercial advantage. Please, someone tell me exactly what commercial advantage means. But at the same time, it's interestingly specific for private monetary compensation. So you sort of get that. That sounds like somebody's selling stuff, and we understand that. Not sure we understand what commercial advantage is. And I think that raises concerns, certainly would raise concerns on the part of some of the societies for whom we publish. There's no question that the position of Wellcome Trust, and we'll probably hear more about this later, and RCUK is that the emphasis on CC BY is important because it means the widest possible use and exploitation, and that's all to society's good. So that's the position that I've heard expressed. But again, we'll hear more about this later. So I guess another question that I posed for this presentation is Creative Commons inevitable for open access? And I think the answer is no. I think from a rational perspective, from a legal perspective, from a business perspective, there is no requirement that a Creative Commons license be used. However, I do believe that some of the characteristics which we associate with Creative Commons are really important. I really like the clarity, the simplicity, the visibility, the real attempt to clarify what is meant by certain terminology. And I think in our world, we do have some online sites that have terms and conditions that are fairly simple and clear, which are not Creative Commons license terms. Although I had to admit, when I looked at most publisher sites, including my own, I couldn't find one, which annoys me, and which we're going to have further discussion about internally later on. In any event, funders are speaking loudly in support of CC-BY, and of course that has a huge market demand. And I think we have to recognize as well that CC licenses have that strong market presence and recognition that I talked about. I did find a nice terms of use on Wikipedia. I don't know if any of you have taken a look at that. Now, I have to admit that this is not a license, the terms of use. I'm sure it's not readable at all. But anyway, you can go on later and take a look at it. But because it's not a license, because actually what happens is you drop down to the bottom of the summary and then you go to an actual further full-blown legal license, which is kind of unfortunate. However, it is a nice attempt, I think, to talk about what is important and to talk about the important issues in a way that can be readable and understandable by humans. And part of that is language. Part of that is also organization and structure. Part of that is kind of laying things out on a page, and probably part of that is some use of, well, they don't use symbols in particular here, but symbols are often helpful and useful, I would say. So I did find one thing that I kind of liked, and I'd suggest is kind of a model for us to look at in terms of greater clarity and greater simplicity. So, wanted to kind of remind you and take this to the association and what the association has been thinking about in this area. You may remember that we did a sustainable open access statement in May 2012. Probably not, okay. Not readable either. The screenshots don't always work very well. But of course, you can go online and read that at your leisure. And I think that was an important statement because what it says is we, as an association, as an industry, and as individual publishers, we want to engage, we want to collaborate, we want to make things work. We just have to do it in a way that makes sense. And also point out the Welcome Trust letter that was transmitted by SDM to its members and was transmitted from WT to SDM for that purpose just a few weeks ago, I believe. But the Copyright Committee for SDM has also been thinking over this past year about whether or not Creative Commons is a good approach and whether it could be improved. And we've had some good discussions with Creative Commons, and we've come to understand a few things. One is that Creative Commons is a complex organization. It has lots of stakeholders and lots of influencers from lots of different directions, so that must be an extremely challenging job. We have to credit Carlos Scala Lavazzari here, outside counsel for SDM, who's probably done the lion's share of all of this work. We have had, I would say, some impact. We've noted some things that could be improved or corrected in the Creative Commons license. I believe they are actually taking those on, and there's a lot of work underway at CC now to come out with a new, more sort of unified version of CC that would be a bit more international and a bit, hopefully, clearer in scope and definition. And so we think we've had some impact on that. We're happy for that. I think ultimately we find, or we believe as a committee, that it's important for us to be clearer than the Creative Commons licenses are on a couple of points. Because of the concern on the no derivative side, we have been working on a CC Plus license that Have we shared it already, or are we about to share it with Creative Commons? I've forgotten.
About to share
it with Creative Commons. In the CC Plus, this is a mechanism by which CC sort of recognizes that there, well, it doesn't recognize necessarily, but there are others out there that are using variants of Creative Commons. What generally happens is they share those variations and versions with Creative Commons. Creative Commons doesn't exactly bless them, but at least it reacts to them if it believes that they are somehow wholly outside the realm of Creative Commons world. So what we hope is that they will say that this is not wholly outside of the realm. And what we did is we started with the ND model, but recognizing some of the critical elements that are going on in our industry, we built in two important derivative uses. One is for text and data mining, for non-commercial text and data mining, and the other is for translation. These are the kinds of derivative uses which we think are quite common and are actually helpful and important elements in what we're trying to do broadly in terms of scientific developments and communications. So those are the key things that we are doing there, and we do hope to be releasing the CC Plus sometime, perhaps even as soon as next month. Certainly. In a month or two. Then the other thing that we've talked about is the notion of a licensing patch. By that we mean, so the way that we see it is there's two things that can be done here. One is you can simply, as a publisher, use the SDM CC Plus if that works for you in a particular application. If it's acceptable, for example, to a particular funder or an author on an author pays model. You can also link to the STM license language on the definition, particularly of commercial, non-commercial. And the reason that we have worked on the commercial definition is we did want to get in this question about advertising and associating content with particular advertising. Because we believe that this is an important way that STM content is sort of commercialized, and it was not entirely clear whether the notion of selling stuff or obtaining commercial advantage was really specific enough with respect to that kind of advertising. So the notion that we have is that we'll put a space on the STM website with the more fuller definition of commercial use. For the non-commercial application, of course, that we'll talk about the advertising, so that a publisher or journal or the author is able to link to that definition and say, yes, we're using the STM, I'm sorry, not the STM, but the CC license. However, we have this definition that we believe is more appropriate for the STM space with respect to commercial use. So it's kind of a linking thing. Now, I have to say, in our discussions with Creative Commons, they're not thrilled about the idea of a licensing patch. They really don't like it. I think they feel that it sort of does away with the core of the CC license, and it may just be a bad practice. They much prefer CC Plus as an approach. I mean, ultimately, they prefer to just use the CC, but given a couple of options, they prefer CC Plus as opposed to a patch. But I think we believe that it's important to give publishers and authors and individual journals some choices and options, and then we can use them or not as it makes sense. So those are the key things that we've been working on, and hope to make that all public quite soon. So I thought I'd just leave a little bit of time for questions. Chris.
Mark, thanks very much for that. I don't think I fully understood the difference between CC Plus and the licensing patch. I just right at the end there, I thought I might have misunderstood it. I might have also mistweeted you. So can you just clarify the two?
Yeah, exactly. So the notion of the CC Plus is that it's a full license in the four corners of the license. It's complete. doesn't refer to anything else, doesn't link to anything else. The patch is, we're going to use a standard CC license, but we have a link here that describes what a particular definition means, or amplifies a particular definition. So it's a bit of a kind of an amendment to an existing CC license.
We actually, a few years ago, I put in place a CC license for our local images, which doesn't have great visibility because it's quite niche, but essentially, we said this is available on this CC license with the additional terms we follow. We didn't actually check the CC on that because, to my mind, there was no reason why we wouldn't do that. CC is openly available to anyone who wants to use it by definition.
Right.
So we took the leap code and added a few more things to it. So a similar approach.
Yeah. Very good.
Has STM engaged with RCUK or the Welcome?
Well, I think STM engages along with PA with the RC UK on a regular basis, a pretty intensive basis, and I certainly think that they have raised concerns about the use of CC BY. Yes.
Hi, Deborah Logan at Elsevier. A quick question for clarification. Usage rights should apply to free non-journal content, so data, webinars, things like that, that we may host, perhaps alongside an open access article. What are the usage rights that should apply to that content?
That's an excellent question. STM has done a couple of statements over the years about data and IP rights, most recently in December. We did an update of that position. Although I have to admit, most of that focuses on the question of the use of licenses and not full transfers, and that there's a distinction between sort of supplemental data databases and data sets. So I don't think we've really addressed the question of usage per se, but because the general position has been that the owners of large databases and data sets are usually only providing a license to the STM publication, the journal in which reference is made, that therefore the usage rights would be set by the owner or the proprietor or the manager of that data. So they'd have to decide.
Right, okay, thanks.
Chris, did you want to respond to the prior question?
What I was going to say is that we haven't been consulted on this, but we'd be very happy to get involved.
Okay. Well, Chris, just to react, we certainly have made our concerns about.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. No, I'm not complaining.
Okay. But we're happy to talk about the alternatives that we've had in mind. That would be great.